Okay, I'm pleased to introduce Jeff Orkin. Is that pronounced right? Jeff.
Yep.
He's a PhD student in the Cognitive Machines Group at MIT Media Lab. Researches in artificial intelligence for characters that learn, and they learn and communicate and collaborate by observing how real people play. So it's an interesting, very interesting topic. He's worked in the game industry on AI systems at Monolith Productions. Did titles of No One Lives Forever 2 and Fear, F-E-A-R. Contributing author to the section editor of the AI Game Programming Wisdom series. Those books. Done presentations at GDC, just happened in San Francisco, although I don't think you presented there, did you?
No, I didn't go this year.
Past GDCs. Has an MS in computer science from the University of Washington and a BS from Tufts right down the road, and with a minor in Studio Art. So thank you.
All right, thanks. Thank you. Thanks to Chuck and Rob for inviting me here. They're not here today, but hopefully they'll watch this video. Hello, Chuck. Hello, Rob. All right, so I'm going to talk about the changes I've seen, the innovations I've seen in AI over the past 10 years or so in games. And I'm not going to, it's not going to be a very deep technical talk. I'm focusing more on why we made certain decisions. And at the same time, I also wanted to give you some insight into what it's like working in the game industry, because I assume many of you are going to go into the industry, and it's kind of a crazy place. So AI for games, we've got it all figured out, right? If we want to make characters interact in a game, we're going to program up some kind of state machine, or maybe we'll program some goals and actions and use some kind of planning system. So now all we need are better tools, right? We're just going to package it up and we'll be all set. So there's all this middleware being introduced, and it's going to solve all our problems, and we're going to have great AI in every game, right? I'm skeptical. I think there's a lot we haven't figured out about AI, especially AI that interacts cooperatively with players, with human players. And I think it could actually stifle innovation rather than promote innovation if we start standardizing and selling AI in a box. And I think where the game industry is right now, it's got a case of physics envy. Everybody looks at the Havok physics engine middleware and says, why can't we have Havok for AI? And in fact, Havok started to make their own AI middleware as well. And it's interesting because game AI is kind of going down the same path that academic AI went down decades ago, and Marvin Minsky, one of the founders of the field of AI, criticized. He said that physics gives us about 5 laws that explain almost everything, so we keep looking for those kinds of simple laws to apply to the brain. You shouldn't be looking for a single explanation of how thinking works. Evolution has found hundreds of ways to do things, and when one of them fails, your mind switches to another. That's resourcefulness. Humans are resourceful. And so let's think about some of the recent trends in game design. Recently, there's been this heightened interest in co-op games, where you can play with a team of players. You can get your friends and go online and go through the mission together. Or if you don't have friends, you could play with AI characters. But invariably, people are disappointed with the AI. Here are a couple reviews where for Army of Two, they say that we really like the direction, but your best bet here is to get a human friend to watch your back. And even Left 4 Dead, very popular, but they say the single-player experience isn't as tasty, simply because the friendly AI can't compare to a human teammate. And then another trend in game design is interactive storytelling, or sometimes it's referred to as drama management. So Facade kind of introduced this idea in 2005. It was this experimental game where you're invited over to Grayson Tripp's apartment for cocktails, and over the course of about 15 minutes of gameplay, they start bickering and their marriage starts falling apart, and you have to try to convince them to keep it together or seek therapy or something before they kick you out of the apartment. And you interact with them through natural language, typing text. So the game always plays through the same scenario. You'll always get kicked out of the apartment at the end, but how it plays out changes depending on your actions. And more recently, Far Cry 2 has tried to adopt these ideas to an action action game, a first-person shooter. And it's also worth mentioning Left 4 Dead with its AI director. This isn't quite the same thing. It's not as complex as a drama manager, but it's a well-executed kind of level randomizer, play balancer, so it's worth mentioning. The problem with these drama management systems is that it's a huge amount of labor to author all of the possible ways the game could play out. Facade, that takes 15 minutes to play, took 5.5 years to create. Clint Hocking, the designer of Far Cry 2, said that developing Far Cry 2, one scripter became two, then three, then a whole team. We were unable to produce a successful walkthrough till 1 week before the master candidate. They were in perpetual crunch. The other problem is players often say that when they're playing these games like Facade or Far Cry 2, they can't tell really what effect their actions are having on the way the game plays out. It feels a little bit random or constricted. And game designer Chris Crawford says that interactivity is all about choices. And if you can't tell what effect your choices have on the game, it's hard to say that it's really an interactive experience. So we've got these two design goals, co-op and storytelling. And they're kind of complementary. Neither one is superior to the other. But co-op is kind of this bottom-up emergent experience where these characters are watching what you do and responding to you and responding to what happens in the world dynamically. And in a storytelling system, it's exhibiting top-down control over the interaction. So it has some story it's trying to tell, and it's trying to kind of force that on what happens and constrain the player in some way. And so each of these offers something that the other lacks, and we really want to integrate them, but it's sort of this impossible problem to solve. So storytelling lacks agency that co-op has, meaning in a co-op game, the player can feel like they're really influencing the world. But on the other hand, in co-op games, it sometimes feels incoherent. Like the characters that are responding to you have no understanding of your long-term goals or the long-term goals of the storytelling and are kind of doing their own thing and getting in the way at times. So ideally, we want a system that brings these together and is both coherent and gives you a feeling of agency in the world. And in my opinion, these are two sides of the same coin, and we really need to think of both of them as being subsets of collaboration, a human-machine collaboration, where the human player is collaborating with the machine to tell an interesting story and incorporate the decisions of the player. But if you want a good collaborative partner, you have to take into account the fact that both the human and the machine have their beliefs about the state of the world and beliefs about what the other human or machine wants, what their goals are. And so we need good communication between the human and the machine. So the machine has to realize that the human needs transparent communication so the human can understand what the machine is thinking, what the characters intend to do, and where the story is trying to go. And the machine needs a good understanding of the human. So the machine needs good models of human behavior so that it can predict what the human's going to do in the future and try to incorporate their goals into the story moving forward. But the problem is, human behavior is complicated. This is a preview of a slide I'll talk about later, but just to give you a preview of what this is a visualization of 5,000 pairs of human players interacting in a virtual restaurant. And you can see there's a huge amount of variability here. And this is what makes me skeptical that our current approaches of hand programming state machines or goals and actions is ever going to fully cover this very dense space of possibilities. And so my perspective comes from the fact that I've kind of been going through my career in AI in reverse, in that first, I got a job programming AI, and then I decided I better learn something about AI, and now I'm going to school to learn about AI. So it's, you know, kind of like I'm not saying I'm Brad Pitt, but I'm living my life in reverse. So I'm going to tell you about where I'm coming from. So I was going to school studying computer science at Tufts in the early 90s, and there was this explosion in the quality of 3D graphics, and I knew, and animation, and I knew I wanted to be part of it in some way. So I minored in art, and I took these 3D animation classes. And senior year, when I was graduating, I applied for a job with a local game company, but I didn't get the job, and so I ended up working for a consulting firm doing management consulting, and I was sitting in meetings like this instead of making games, and I was very depressed. And so in my free time, I read books like Tricks of the Game Programming Gurus, which in 1995, that was about the only book you could get on the subject. There definitely weren't undergrad game development curriculums like you guys have. And I programmed my first game for PC. And then about a year later, I sent out 20 resumes to game companies around the country and faced a lot of rejection and finally landed a job at Sierra. And Sierra in 1996 was not a very desirable studio to work for. They were just cranking out these sequels to their same old franchises, King's Quest, Leisure Suit Larry. But I was just thrilled to get into the industry. And I was assigned to work on King's Quest VIII, Mask of Eternity. So I got there, and my first assignment was to program Save Game, because somebody's got to program that. And I did that, and it worked out okay, and they were happy with it. So assignment number two, artificial intelligence. I don't know. I didn't know anything about AI, but basically no one else wanted to do it. All the experienced guys were busy with graphics. And this was the first in-house 3D game, which was very difficult for the company. But you have to realize the bar was very low for AI at the time. The previous King's Quest games really didn't have an AI. They were these animated scenes for point-and-click adventure games. But the company was trying to get with the times in the 90s and keep up with what was going on in the consoles with these new types of 3D adventure games like Tomb Raider and Mario 64. And so King's Quest VIII was a 3D first or third person game that can combine adventure with a little bit of combat. But the requirements were very simple. Basically, we had monsters, and there was the hero, the player, and if the hero came close enough to a monster, it should run right at him and attack him. So I programmed a state machine that basically looked like this. So in C++, we had classes for states, and guys could wander around and chase you and attack, and they could die. But pretty soon we ran into this problem. If the monster detected the hero and started running at him, but there was an obstacle in his way, like, say, a building, he would just run into it and start running in place. So ideally, we'd want him to run around the building. So you guys are studying game development. How should I solve this problem? Anyone? I think I heard someone whisper A star. Good answer. And that is what I should have done, but I didn't even know pathfinding algorithms were like a well-studied problem. I'd never heard of A star. So this was my solution. I just ran into things, or let the character run into things, and when it collided with something, turned a random direction for a couple seconds, and then tried again and again, and we hoped the player wouldn't really notice. And this is how we shipped the game. And it wasn't elegant, but this was kind of the least of the problems for King's Quest VIII. At the time, 3D hardware was new. There were all kinds of driver problems. People couldn't run the game. The game took 3 years to develop, went a year over schedule. That was a typical amount of time now, but at that time, a very long time to develop one game. So we were heroes at the company for shipping anything. And when we finished this game, the core team of programmers, me and two other guys, said, we've really bonded on this project, and we'd like to work on a new project together. And Sierra said, we can't have three competent programmers on the same team. And they split us up, and they made us lead programmers on three new franchises. But at this time, Sierra was going through a lot of management turmoil. When I started at Sierra, they had just been bought by the company that owned the entertainment books. They wanted to use games to sneak onto your computer, kind of like early spyware. And they merged with this company that owned the Avis car rental service. And they formed this new company, Sendint, this big conglomerate. And soon after they merged, it was announced that they had found hundreds of millions of dollars of accounting fraud. So the company kind of imploded, and the software division was sold to a 100-year-old French water company that was getting into media. So Vivendi bought us, and meanwhile, we're trying to make games in the middle of all this craziness, people getting laid off. And so within a year, so they had a scripted system for Nulf1, and when I got there, that sounded like a good approach to me versus the hard coding I'd done before. And the way this worked is a designer would set a character into an initial state, like patrolling, and then there would be hooks that the designer could send commands on, like, if you hear something, go into the investigate state, or if you see someone, go attack from cover and use this cover node. A node is like an invisible position. And then there were some hard-coded states, like you could die from anywhere, and if the player ran too far from your cover, it was hard-coded to then start chasing him around. So this seemed to work pretty well, but the designers weren't happy with it. You could also die from there. So the designers weren't very happy. The problem was you'd have this AI. He starts out, he's patrolling. He sees an enemy. He goes and he starts attacking from cover. The player runs away, and the AI starts chasing. And at this point, there's no more hooks available to the designer, so the AI will just chase you forever. So it's kill or be killed, fight to the death. And this is supposed to be a stealthy spy game, and if you accidentally alert too many enemies, you'll end up with a crowd of enemies chasing you around, and you're invariably going to die. And you don't feel like a super spy when you're reloading over and over. And it's frustrating, and it's not fun. And you might think, well, couldn't they just have a timeout and after a while the AI give up and just start patrolling again? But the problem is, when they're chasing you, they could have run anywhere in the level, and they have all of these commands set, and it's kind of like a Rube Goldberg machine where once you've sprung all the traps, it's really impossible to automatically set it back up to its starting state. So what they were asking for, the designers were asking for autonomy. They wanted characters that could figure out for themselves what to do no matter where they found themselves. So we implemented a goal system. So goals were these black boxes where one goal could control the behavior at a time, and each goal had a small state machine encoded inside of it. And goals had activation functions, and they had priorities, and they would compete for relevance. So you'd have a guy patrolling. When he hears something, he starts investigating. If he sees someone, he starts attacking. He can find his own cover positions. If the player evades him and hides, the AI eventually will start searching for him, and if he can't find them, he'll say, oh no, he got away, and he'll go back to patrolling. And to allow the AI to understand the world, we kind of borrowed an idea from The Sims of smart objects. We tagged the world with all of these different objects that the AI could interact with, and these smart objects would announce their affordances of how you could interact with them. You could open a file cabinet and ruffle through it. You could sleep on the couch. You could work at a desk. You could drink coffee. You could take cover behind things. You could flip things over. And this gave the feeling that the characters were really living in the world. As a player sneaking around as a spy, he could observe what's happening with these characters in their natural habitat and kind of strategize on how to carry out the player's plans. We also wanted the AI to coordinate and work together, but there wasn't any time in the schedule. It was a pretty quick game, about 18 months. There wasn't any time to implement a big system for coordination, but we found some tricks that kind of gave the illusion of coordination. So the way pathfinding worked in Nulf 2 was with these rectangular volumes that marked walkable space. So if enemy A and B are running towards a player or their enemy E, they would pathfind. All of these pathfinding volumes have cost 1, so that's the cheapest path that you see there. But we wanted them to look like they were working together, so the first guy to set a path would reserve one of the volumes, which would make the cost of it appear artificially high temporarily to the other AI. And so enemy B would say, oh, that looks like a really expensive path. I'm going to take this other path. And they would end up coming around at different directions at the player rather than the Congo line all coming the same way. And to the player, it looks like they're coordinating, flanking, and you can even add some audio cues where they say, like, split up when they know they're taking a non-reserve path. So we shipped NULF 2, and I had a great time working on it, and I'm proud of it. It was a really fun game, and it won some awards, but it didn't actually sell all that well. It kind of missed the target audience for first-person shooters with its female super spy, and you're using the lipstick camera and the makeup code breaker. It just somehow wasn't connecting with the audience of first-person shooters. So I think it sold somewhere around 400,000. And so after that, we got the publishing deal to make NULF 3, but we secretly decided instead to make Fear. And luckily, by the time we showed the publisher, they agreed this had more market potential. And so Fear, you're this like special forces guy brought in to this crazy... I can't recap the whole story of Fear, but there... It doesn't matter. So you're brought in to fight these evil guys, and there's an evil scientist and a little girl controlling them with her mind. And anyway, we were focusing on squad behaviors in this game that we didn't really have time to address in the last game. And the idea was we wanted to create an experience that felt like multiplayer against teams of trained humans. So we implemented this... this global, omnipotent coordination, squad coordinator system. And this would look at the AI characters and automatically group them into squads based on proximity. And then it would kind of act as a puppet master, sending commands to them, telling them how to carry out different tactics. So, for example, if the player's firing at one guy in a squad, the squad coordinator will tell another guy to lay suppression fire. Well, the guy in trouble goes to a valid cover position. And in the process, he might run around a hallway or an obstacle, and it will appear to the player like they're flanking. The squad coordinator sending down these commands, but the AI could then respond to the commands autonomously. So we implemented this planning system. Instead of going the NULF 2 route, where we hard-coded state machines inside of goals, we had goals and plans decoupled, and we would actually search in real time for a sequence of actions to satisfy a goal. So if an AI character wanted to eliminate a threat, he could do this search in reverse and say, well, to eliminate a threat, I need to attack him. But to attack him, I need to be close enough to hit him. And I need a weapon, and so I either need to pull out my weapon, or if I don't have one, I can pick it up. And to pick it up, I need to go to the position of the weapon. So in real time, we can formulate a plan of go to the weapon, pick it up, go to an attack position or a cover position, start attacking to try to eliminate the threat. And the big benefit of this to the player was that the characters would really adapt their behavior to the player's game-playing style. So as an example of this, I have two videos of the same scenario. So the player's in this room, and the AI is on a patrol route that includes checking this room periodically. So the AI, you'll see him come by the window, and he comes and he opens this door, and he sees me, and he starts firing. So now I'm going to run this again, but in the second run, I'm going to block the door physically with my body. And it's a little hard to see, but there's a security monitor over here. And on the monitor, you'll see the AI replan twice. So first, he's planning to patrol, and he opens the door. The door won't open, so he registers in his working memory that the door is blocked. And he replans and decides to kick it. His new plan, he kicks, and that fails to open it. So he replans one more time and looks for another way to get into the room that he's now concerned about. So he comes around as before. We block the door with our body. You can see the security monitor. He opens it. He kicks it. Replans again. Comes around and finds another way to come at us. So this creates really dynamic gameplay where characters are kind of constantly shifting around and altering their strategies to adapt to the player. And it was important to us that the player realizes these characters are coordinating intentionally. It's not just coincidence that they're coming from different directions or executing different kinds of tactics. So wherever possible, we use dialogue instead of just having one character speak. So typically in games, when you shoot at someone, they have pain sounds. We got rid of the pain sounds and instead had this dialogue where someone else would say to someone who was shot, "What's your status?" And the guy who got shot would say, "I'm hit," or "I'm all right." If the player evaded the enemy and hides, someone else will say, "Can you see anything?" And the guy who can't see you anymore says, "No, sir." Or maybe we tag different areas so somebody else could say, "He's behind the boxes," or "He's in the ceiling." In ceilings with these drop tiles like this, you could climb up. Oh, yeah?
I'm curious. When he came through the window,
yeah.
He physically hit you with the gun instead of backing up and shooting him.
Yeah, that's also the planning system, in that when he rolled, he ended up very close to me, and then he has a goal of attacking, and he can attack melee or attack ranged, and he'll prefer to attack ranged. That's a less costly action, but has a precondition that you're close enough to hit with your ranged weapon. So,
okay, so it's not how much damage I do. It's
no. In that case, the idea is to look smart about not wasting your ammunition.
Okay.
But you could choose. There's a lot of
If he's holding a pistol, better to club.
Yeah. Right, yeah. There's a lot of crafting on the part of the AI designer where you can choose what would you rather see, or you can also make things happen 50% one way and 50% another. So we can also use dialogue to explain a lack of action. If you're firing at an AI and he's not moving, you might assume the AI system is broken, the character is stupid. But if you hear this dialogue where someone's yelling, "He's aiming at you, get out of there," and he says, "I've got nowhere to go," you understand that he can't find a better tactical position, and the AI doesn't look so dumb. So we've kind of got what I was talking about earlier. We've got this integration of top-down coordination with bottom-up emergent planning. But we're able to do this because it's a squad of AI-controlled characters. And they can read each other's minds. They don't truly have to communicate. The coordinator just gives them kind of a script of what to say to each other. And the coordinator can send instructions directly to them, and it can read their minds as well. So it's a whole different ballpark when you introduce a human into the squad, because now they can't read the human's mind. The coordinator can't talk to the human. The human's not going to necessarily listen to a coordinator anyway. And the human doesn't know what the AI are thinking and what they want to communicate to each other. So suddenly we have to really implement some form of collaboration rather than doing it all with smoke and mirrors as we could before. And so as far as transparent communications, there are things we can do with the interface. Just one idea is what they did with... In Black and White 1, people complained that, yeah, you can teach these characters, but nobody could tell what they're actually learning, and it seemed a little bit arbitrary. So in Black and White 2, they introduced these thought bubbles where you could actually see what the creatures are thinking, what they're believing, what they're learning, and you can correct that. And people responded well to this. One reviewer said it made the game much more transparent, finally creating a viable process for turning the creature into more than a useless, oversized Tamagotchi. But when it comes to modeling the behavior that lets AIs predict and understand what the human's goals are, there are efforts underway to use hierarchical planning systems. But I'm still skeptical that by hand we can get from this to this. That's still a huge leap, and I'm not convinced that hand-coded hierarchical planning is going to cover the full space of possibilities. And if you think about other aspects of game development, pretty much every other discipline in game development starts by capturing some data from the real world. You know, when we want human animation, we do motion capture. We record human voices. We use digital photography to create realistic textures. We scan people's faces to get 3D models. So why should we think that when it comes to communication and coordination, collaboration, behavior, we can just code that up from scratch. It'll be fine. But there's this question of how do you capture behavior? It's sort of an abstract thing. How do you capture communication? And I think there are a number of approaches we can take. So starting with, I think the most obvious is there are already 11 million people in games like World of Warcraft. These people are generating data every day as we speak, and we're just throwing it away. Wouldn't it be great if we could capture it and use it in some way to create behavior for AI characters that could play on your guild with you? Then Spore is an interesting idea where Will Wright coined the term massively single-player game because you play Spore on your own, but you create these characters that are automatically uploaded to centralized servers and shared with everyone else who's playing Spore, so you're benefiting from a community of millions of players. And I wonder if we could do something similar with AI, where the behavior you exhibit when you're playing characters gets shared with other people and downloaded into their games, and your game just continues to get better on your desktop. Characters communicate better, characters work together better. And Spore did something interesting. They had this problem. You know, there's this chicken and egg problem of if your game depends on data, then don't you have to make the game before you can make the game so that you can capture the data? And so Spore released a demo of the creature editor for free before the game came out, and people created all these creatures that then populated the game when it shipped. So I think that's an interesting model. And then you have to realize that it's not like every game is totally original and we start from scratch every time. There are behaviors that I re-implemented from Nulf 1 to Nulf 2, re-implemented again from Nulf 2 to Fear. Plus the way designers, this is designer Craig Hubbard, who designed the Nulf games and Fear, the way he would communicate what he wanted to me was he would say things like, all right, these guys are going to fight like the Marines in Half-Life. So, you know, if we think long-term, instead of thinking, instead of this short-term, you know, only thinking about shipping the next game, we can start capturing data today from our current games that may be useful in future games. There's also this interesting idea. I don't know what's happened to this game, but I read about this game, The Crossing, that says it's fusing single-player with multiplayer. So it's a single-player action game, but other people online can log into your game and play the enemies. And so they're just doing this to control the characters, but what if you also recorded what they do when they log in and use that so that you could play this game when you're not logged on online as well? And Halo 3, there's this great article in Wired about how they do all of this extensive gameplay testing, and they have these visualization tools, and they make this data available to designers so that they can see where people are getting stuck, where are they lost, where are they dying more often than we want them to. So they're using this data for balancing to inform their designers, and I think this is the right direction, but what if we take it the next step and we actually collect this data at a finer grain level of what characters are actually doing in a form that we could actually model new behavior from to control characters. And Fable 2, allegedly, according to Peter Molyneux, who you can't always trust, but he says that for Fable 2, they brought in real actors who acted on stage. I think they did this for their cutscenes. And so before they created anything in the game itself, they videotaped real actors and figured out how they wanted scenes to play out and used that as a reference for their designers to stage these cutscenes. And I think that's a really interesting idea. But what if we brought in actors that actually played in the game itself and improvised different scenes, and we captured that data and used it to control characters? So there's this spectrum of possibilities. And right now, all games on the market are on the right-hand side of the spectrum. We create everything by hand. We either designers or programmers, one way or another, through scripts or C++ code, create the behavior. Right now in grad school, I've been exploring the other end of the spectrum, where we learn everything from data collected from humans. And ultimately, what I'm working towards is finding the sweet spot that's somewhere on the spectrum where we capture data and we make it available to designers in some form that lets them kind of sculpt the behavior they want out of things that people actually do in the game. And so those are the ideas I had in mind when I started the restaurant game project. It's still online. You can download it and play it on Mac or Windows. It's based in the Torque game engine. I'll show you the game itself after I have a handful more slides. But basically, you can communicate by typing text, and you can interact with the world through a point-and-click interface. And it's a very open-ended environment where you can do whatever you want. We hope we'll get a lot of restaurant behavior, but people can really do whatever they want. And so when you're capturing data in the wild from the general public, you never know what you're going to get. Soon after we launched the game, I got this email from some guy saying another player and I stacked cheesecake plates until we could step onto the roof of the restaurant. Has this done before? Are we some kind of pioneers? And he attached a screenshot. So people do crazy stuff. In the interest of time, I'm going to skip this audio clip from NPR, but Ira Flatow talks about someone stealing the cash register when he was playing. But the surprising thing is that over half of the players play mostly regular restaurant stuff. They do restaurant things. And when you have that much good data, a lot of the strange behavior kind of washes away. And we're running out of time. I hear we're going to be kicked out precisely at... So I'm going to skip to the demo. But we capture this data. The statistics let us wash away the weird stuff and find the good stuff. We can make better models that we can use to control characters. We can also find recurring phrases and think about the future. There's all kinds of processing power available, blah, blah, blah. Okay. So until we get kicked out, I'll show you as much as I can. So this is the game. Yeah, yeah. So two people go on at a time. You're anonymously paired. And you go online, and it's first person. You're either a customer or a waitress. Here I'm the customer. You can see my body. You can see I'm walking. There's a whole world here, but somehow there's only one restaurant in this town. So you come in here, and if there was someone playing, they would control the waitress, and you could talk to her. You could say hello, and she would respond in text up above. And you can interact with the world. Everything is the same option. So I can choose to eat the chair, but that probably doesn't make as much sense as sitting on the chair. And over watching, observing lots of people, we can learn the right affordances. You can pick up pretty much anything that's not too heavy. So now I've got this flower. I'm going to give it to the waitress. I can eat it. I can pick up the menu. The menu's in my hand. I can read it. I can tell someone what I want to order. I can put it down. You get the idea, but just to show you, one steak, please. The chef is hard-coded to understand some keywords. He cooks me up a new steak. I can take a few bites. I could serve it to someone. And so we can learn these two roles of customer and waitress. I can eat the fruit. I can turn on the microwave. I can sit on top of the fridge. I can eat the trash. I can, give the trash to somebody. So you get the idea. And so in about 10 or 15 minutes, we can let people dramatize what they do in a restaurant. And then we also capture their dialogue. So I'm going to give you two quick demos if we have time. So I need a volunteer. Volunteer, quick. Anyone, it's easy. Okay. No, you can stay there. Okay, you are the waitress in the restaurant, or kind of the hostess, waitress, whatever. Customer walks in the front door. What do you say to that customer? So you say...
Welcome to the restaurant.
Thanks. And then you might say...
Right this way, please.
Hey.
What can I get you to drink? Yes, please. Wow. Okay, this worked not very well. So what I'm trying to show is that rather than hand-coding dialogue, we can learn recurring patterns in dialogue. And so this is not intended to be any kind of final product, but it's just demonstrating what we can get totally automatically. And it often works better than that. So I'm going to try it one more time with someone else. Anyone? All right. Well, what do you say? Someone walks in. Good afternoon. Ahoy. And keep in mind, the customer just walked up to the podium. He hasn't sat down or anything, and so. How many in your party? One. All right, follow me. KK. And then maybe. Have a seat. I'd like a table for one, please. Okay. Well, obviously there's still more work to do, but just to show you some of the other things, like you can ask them smoking or non. Non, thank you for asking. Do you have a reservation? Yes, ma'am, I'm here on behalf of the gaming company. Where would you like to sit? Don't mind, thanks. So you get the idea. And so now we've incorporated this back into the game just as an experiment, as an exploration of what can we get without doing any hand programming. So if we go back into the game, oops. We go back in, and this time we're going to let the machine control both characters, and we're going to observe, but there's no centralized control. As far as they're concerned, either one could be a human that they're responding to. So I'm going to fly over here, and we're just going to watch these characters interact dynamically using data that they've learned. And they're not allowed to reference the same log as each other, so they're not sharing. They're not locking onto one log file. Are you from New Orleans? California. Okay. She gives him a menu. May I suggest some wine? Glass of Fournignon, glass of red wine. Okay. Filet mignon. She orders a steak. Takes a drink. So this will just continue running infinitely, and we're probably about to get kicked out, but that was running with a random seed that I've seen before, so I knew you would see something reasonable. And now I'll just let it run with a random seed, and just show you what you get. It's every time it's a little different, and sometimes it can be inappropriate, but. And so the idea with all this is that this is a starting point that then designers can build from rather than writing everything from scratch. Obviously, this isn't perfect, but it gives you a lot more than starting with a blank page. And it's accessible to designers that don't necessarily know how to program. Hi, please take a seat. Where is he? Oh, there he is.
Any table? The menu is on the table. Thank you. Would you like a table? Sure you would.
Come on.
I'll get you a menu. Okay. So anyway, so we're continuing to work on this and trying to refine the behavior so they have more memory about things that have happened in the past and that they can constrain the situation to kind of a more ordinary sequence of events. And this is long-term research that's going to take another couple years. So I think we're out of time, but I don't know. If anyone has questions, I'm happy to...
Yeah, quick question or two?
Yeah.
Nope. Okay, so...